Welcome to the RAND CRE Show. Commercial real estate with no stone left unturned.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the RAND CRE Show. I'm your host, Mike Tarvello, with my co-host, Will Coleman. Will, how's it going today?
Doing well, Mike. Just running the marathon one step at a time. Today, we've got James Shukas on the show. Probably more excited for this guest than any guest we've had so far. So to give a bit of a background, I worked at Citibank for 2 years.
And the real Citibank.
The real Citibank, C-I-T-Y, which is a community bank based out of Texas. choking here a little bit. Headquartered in Lubbock. And when I started Citibank, James was a lender there and was very insightful to me in terms of any questions I had. James almost always knew the answer and then some. James has nearly 20 years of experience in the community banking space. He was a commodities trader, has a ton of stories, traded commodities in like cotton and different industries in Vietnam and Thailand and all kinds of stuff, but very knowledgeable in the community banking space and especially kind of the pricing of community bank debt and the situation we're in right now with a lot of uncertainty in the lending environment. I very much wanted to have James on the show. So James, thanks for being on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. Excited.
Yeah.
First podcast.
So. Buckle up, everyone. Here we go.
Yep.
James was known to have some random pranks at the office, so be warned.
He's a prank. And even before the recording, the whiteboard behind James, I guess Will and James would go through it several times with all the theories and stuff. So it's going to be a lot of value provided on this podcast today.
Sweet.
We hope so.
The first thing I just wanted to ask is, you know, give us a sense of the community banking space in Texas and then kind of how you guys are operating in it. You know, we've heard a lot of banks that are pulling back on leverage, and I'm sure, you know, everyone is being a little bit more conservative right now. But just kind of give us a feel of what you're seeing in that space.
Sure. And, you know, this is a little bit different, the whole COVID pandemic and, you know, what we're facing right now versus what we saw in 2008. Just because, you know, today you've got an economic crisis brought on by a pandemic versus, you know, a true economic and financial crisis back in 08 that was brought on by, you know, massive underlying credit problems. Your whole credit and banking system was really fast and loose, which was, you know, ripe for a disaster. And so we are a bit more optimistic right now because going through this, you don't have the credit problems and you don't have the massive amounts of leverage. And we think that a lot of our projects and a lot of what's out there in the market is just a little more credit worthy going into this than what was going into 2008. And so, you know, from where we are and most other banks, I think, you know, everybody kind of slowly started just pulling back a little bit because when you don't know what's going to happen and you're sort of managing 7 days out, which everybody's doing, you know, consumers are doing, the general public is doing, folks that have kids going back to school are doing, you still don't have plans, really anything beyond 7 days. And so it's very hard for a bank and any type of business to forecast what you're going to do beyond that. So, so what you do is you don't do anything. And that's not good for businesses. That's not good for the general economy. And a lot of what happened in 08 is everybody stopped lending. And that you saw how credit dependent all spaces were, whether it was manufacturing, industrial, retail, restaurant, hospitality, when all lending just stops, that's dangerous. Mm-hmm. Because we love debt, businesses do. And I think, but now it's more of a, think of it as kind of a downshifting. We've sort of downshifted from fifth to fourth. And then I think now you're seeing, you know, a little bit of a fourth to third gear downshift. So you guys are too young to have manual transmission cars, but
mean D, the letter D, right?
Yeah, your paddle shifters. So, so we have pulled back a little bit. I think most community banks have, just as we're getting our guidance from regulators and examiners, and all that comes from them being slightly more critical of certain areas. Rightfully so, hotels that you know, one day had 85-90% occupancy went to 10-20% in some cases percent occupancy. And so certain spaces have definitely become more sensitive. And as a result, we just yesterday came back with some revisions to our credit policy. And I think this is probably the change, you know, that what you're asking about, what you're looking for, saying, okay, maybe we were going to do some real estate at 85% leverage for a single family residence, or now we're looking at 80. So we're not doing, we specifically, and I think a lot of our peer groups are not doing what we did in 08. They just said, we're not going to make any residential loans anymore for a while. We said, look, we're absolutely willing to still take care of our clients, make sure that that we are evaluating things correctly, but we want to do it with just slightly less leverage. So I
think that's an important note of the 08-09. It's, and being a CPA, people always wonder, like, why do you need debt, right? And so one of the key is the current ratio, just making sure how much assets your current liabilities have, and having that close to one as possible. So you need leverage to run and sustain a business. And like James was saying, once that hose just stops and halts, each domino falls. And I like the future seven. Everyone's looking at T12s, T3s, T1s, but the next 7 days, what's going to happen? No one really knows. And just that uncertainty piece is hard, you know, in your personal life, but on the banking side, it's going to be even harder to model and figure out. So I think I like the future seven is a key metric I think we'll all be seeing moving forward.
Yeah. And you guys are seeing all in different industries. Like, you guys lend on retail, hotels, apartments, single family. What are you seeing in not necessarily every single industry, but is there anything that's standing out in terms of industries you are staying away from or feel more comfortable with, or people that are asking for more debt in certain industries?
Sure. No, it's it is great to be in the single, the single family business right now. Okay. And I read some reports even this morning that, I don't know if you remember Residential Strategies that we used to subscribe to. We've got the first quarter and we're looking at preliminary second quarter data. And I'll tell you what, just they're saying housing is just white hot. And so, and that's housing probably 400 and below. What happens is when people are buying those, you're getting a mortgage that's considered conforming in the secondary market. So it's easy to originate. It's easy to sell in the secondary market. Mortgage companies like those, banks like those. And then at the same time, we've really had a shortage of affordable housing. So what a lot of these folks did in maybe some of your outline, what you call secondary markets, is they've gone out, bought lots, developed lots, and then are providing good, you know, new affordable housing, and not having to pay high premium prices for, you know, 15 and 20, in some cases 30 and 40 year old product, you know, in town. And so, yeah, residential real estate kind of below the, call it below 400, 450 is really doing fantastic. Still difficult to buy on kind of the lower end. If you're looking at rental properties, it's really, those prices have stayed up there. So it's hard to find the value add stuff that's out there. And I think even in some other markets, I've got a friend that works in Memphis, and he said it's just impossible to find investor real estate at a reasonable dollar amount. And so, but yeah, the other spaces that we've shied away, really, I say shied away from, but just pulled back our reins a bit. Hospitality. I've got a couple of retail developments that are kind of being white boxed right now, ready for tenants. But they're in good locations with strong principals. And so, we're not, there still are your bigger chains, maybe your larger franchises or bigger businesses are still actively seeking, you know, good markets, good hard corners. And so we are seeing a little bit of a slowdown, really more of an adjustment in how they're operating, with, you know, like I said, the mask, the social distancing and all that. Retail has certainly slowed. And Will, I don't know if you remember, one of our clients that is in the IHOP business, she had, you know, several of those. She went from really people not going into her stores at the very beginning of this pandemic. And now she got back to just about 80% of their normalized revenues there toward the end of June. And now as rumors of kind of the second wave come through, that she's dipped a bit, but you can see how really it's almost become like a deep V, where it dropped off precipitously on the front end for, and then it's now it's, analysts are predicting a very quick rebound in certain areas. The ones that we have adjusted our policy more in will be your hospitality space, anything that's travel and tourism related, just because those are the ones that are we feel are getting the longer term impact. I'll tell you, my manufacturing companies are doing extraordinarily well. Industrial, warehouse and light industrial is doing incredibly well. They're continuing to kind of power through. And so, you know, you have some areas that have felt it more than others. And so what we've tried to do is identify those and you know, say that we're not going to do that because we have clients in the hospitality space. And so, you know, looking for, you know, some toward the government programs, the Main Street lending, that's just kind of rolling out. We're trying to figure out how that might apply and how that might work for some of our clients as well.
I was going to say, for the single family space, I know I just sold my first single family investment back home in Michigan.
He got his check today.
Got my check today. And it's true. It's like all the things you're saying are like the macros, right? Affordable housing has been in demand and people want to take advantage of those low interest rates. My buddy refied back in Michigan, like under 3. Mm-hmm. So it's been phenomenal. But I think the biggest thing to take away is adjust, right? Our team on the property management side, we did online leasing, virtual leasing in a matter of 30 days. And the IHOPs and like all the restaurants that we've seen that have done well have done like the curbside pickups and really just been cognizant of it. So I think the biggest takeaway seeing, you know, from Texas or even anywhere in the country, right, is adjusting your model to make sure you're underwriting those risks, but also the new way of doing business for now and how to understand what's going on every day.
Well, you hit it on the head. Those low mortgage rates have absolutely been, you know, your safety net right now. And so as a company that has a large mortgage subsidiary, you know, we had a bank-wide call the other day and our CEO said, look, if you see somebody from the mortgage company, give them a Corona high five because they're carrying the lion's share of the weight right now. Wow. And they're really producing extraordinarily well. And so and then we're even seeing, like Mike said, dipping into the twos on some of those rates, which is nuts, you know, a high two. And I didn't think it'd get below when we had refinanced at like 3.6 or 3.4. And so, yeah, absolutely. If you're a homeowner or an investor, and you're younger, what I'm telling our folks is, and you know, coaching them is, look, accelerate your debt because you won't ever see it as cheap as it is today. And so if you can lock in a, you know, lower rate, maybe if it does force you to pay slightly more for the asset, but there's always a give and take. And so as those rates are going to tick back up, yeah, you're going to find some better deals, but your cost of debt will be more.
And what are you seeing on the commercial side for rates? I mean, are you guys low fives, high fours? Where is that targeting on? You know, I guess it depends a lot on the asset, but you know, let's stick to multifamily and maybe.
Okay.
I guess let's just stick for multifamily right now. What rates are you kind of seeing in the multifamily and housing sector for the most part?
Multifamily is interesting, you know, sort of per bank. It's always, I kind of, you know, allude to like, it's like dealer's choice. So different banks are going to price it a bit differently. And some are far more aggressive than others. Mm-hmm. But most commercial banks around our size that are playing in the same markets that we are still going to have, if it's got any rehab or stabilization component, if it's interest only on the front end. So if it's interest only, you're looking at a floating rate at maybe a prime plus, you know, anywhere from a half to one, depending on the leverage. The lower lever projects are going to be closer to the prime plus a half floating. And then with a stabilization, if you recall, we'll give them a little bit of a mini perm on the back end once they're stabilized to let them roll into an amortization. And then we might look at treasuries for that, or we might just say, what we've done lately, because treasuries have kind of dipped so low, is say, look, we're really not going to go below 4.25 on some of our investor real estate. Just to, you know, obviously we'll look at special cases if it's lower leverage, if there's some sort of, risk mitigant that's there, because banks are in the business of risk. And so the way you reflect that is in the price. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if there's some, you know, if there's a higher risk component, then, you know, potentially we could be higher than that. So, but we are seeing, we've pulled back a bit in multifamily, but really not, you know, we've had positive, you know, population and job growth here in the Metroplex. And so, and really the paradigm shift, and you know, we keep talking about this affordable housing, but for people coming out of college, and it's really not affordable. We say it's affordable because it's the lower price point and it's conforming from a mortgage standpoint. But you know, when you're coming out of school, it's not affordable. Maybe if you're married, you have someone else that's you're going to get some roommates and they've got good jobs too. Yeah, you know, buy a house and do that thing. But we're seeing a bit of a transition to, you know, walk and leave. They want apartments in parts of town where you can walk to, you know, maybe some restaurants or some entertainment. The condo townhome product has absolutely just, I mean, done so well here where maybe it's 2,500 square feet, 2,300 square feet, three stories straight up, a little bit of a rooftop deck, no yard. You know, and those are going to start probably in the low threes to mid threes. So yeah, for those, that's highly appealing. But yeah, the multifamily, I think we've still maintained a decent level of confidence in that because of the job growth, because of the population growth here, and just the area where we're in. People kind of, you know, they migrate. We do most multifamily in the city, and so if you are in those secondary markets or a market that's highly influenced by maybe energy or construction, and you're probably going to see some more volatility in that multifamily. But I feel like we remain competitively priced.
I wanted to touch on the college students who are leaving college, because just seeing the student housing project developments, I would never want to graduate college because they're just the new A++. So when you said it's not affordable, that was the thing that resonated with. You're staying in brand new builds, high A+ amenities. You leave college and then you're like, wait, why would I want a house? Why would I want to do everything? Like, now we're seeing just these immaculate apartment townhomes even. So you're getting the top of the line treatment for much, much different price point than you were buying homes. So, and less the responsibilities. So that was one point that resonated really well with.
Well, and the criteria has changed a little bit for people looking at apartments versus houses, because if you look at, if someone is searching for a house, they're, you know, I want 2,500 square feet, or I want, you know, they start sort of, it's like you back into what you want and you beginning with a size. But for multifamily and renters, they say I can spend $1,200 a month. And then they start, they categorize it by what they can spend per month and where they want to live. And so the criteria are a bit different for those. And so where we have focused, you know, some of our lending is the areas where we know kind of your top and bottom rents for what they're going to get in those markets, you know, for what certain streets, certain neighborhoods, certain zip codes, we've even been able to narrow it down to there. And we've really focused on our clients, you know, either buying stuff and renovating, and generally you can't make those rents if it's a new build because your rents are more. But yeah, gutting and renovating, and then leasing at where someone just says, look, I'm looking for $1,200 a month. It may be 600 square feet on one street. It may be 750 square feet on another street, but it doesn't matter because they want to walk to, you know, the places, and they've got a dog park there. And, those are the things that I think today are, and also they influence, you know, kind of where we're wanting to land.
Yeah. No, it's fun listening to you talk. Cause a lot of times when I talk to people about rates on bank loans, I always bring up, well, it depends on the amount of risk on the deal itself. And I don't know if I've ever like thought to myself where I got that from, but as soon as I heard you talking, I was like, oh, I got it from James. Because I mean, it really does matter. Like, you can't just say, you know, rates are 4.25% on all asset classes in multifamily. It's like, you look at the deal and say, where do we see the risk? How are we going to adjust our pricing based off that? Because if there's more risk, we want to make more money. Whereas if there's less risk, you know, we're okay taking more of a haircut on the deal. So it's just important to kind of note that when looking at how banks will price stuff.
And remember too, banks are commodities. I mean, my money is as green as every other bank's. And so the key differentiator is you have those key banking relationships as a client, as an investor. And yeah, you know, if you just walked into a bank and said, what are your rates? They're going to give you kind of their rack rate, which is what apartments call, or hotels will, you know, give you if you don't have, you're not a rewards member, you don't, you know, discount. They're going to charge you the rack rate, which is basically retail. And so, but if you've got a relationship with a bank and you've done, you know, a couple of projects with them, they're going to start to give you, you're going to be able to whittle your pricing down because of, you know, because that like you said, that perceived risk goes down. You become a known quantity. Yep. And so, and all banks, they're going to price in different markets. Small markets price different than big markets and for projects and risk. But man, I anytime I see on my caller ID a phone from a client, you know, I immediately want to give them the best that we have to offer. So I'm in some cases going to try to negotiate against myself because I want them to feel like, you know, they want to continue to call me because, hey, look, you know, I may not be the cheapest game in town, but I'm still competitive for them.
Yeah.
Well, and plus too, I think it's reducing the risk. So your first loan, it's like the first date. And then once it's like 5-10, it's like whatever you need, we'll get there, close it, make it happen because you've done it. So by proving yourself over time, and I think a lot of people think of the deal, but the bank's also looking at the management team. So if it's everyone's first at bat, there's going to be a lot more risk associated than like, all right, deal 10, James, what's going on? Let's get this deal done. No, you know what I mean? So it's all teed up. So I think those are important factors, not just the deal, but the management team itself, the experience that team is bringing, et cetera.
Yeah,
for sure.
And so I want to get into pricing a little bit later on in terms of how you guys price it, but I'd love to hear about PPP loans. I mean, I know that I've talked to some of my old coworkers and you know, some are working Saturdays, but at the same time, while they have to work at home. So just giving some insight into what you're seeing in PPP loans. Are y'all, is it the majority of what you guys are working on right now, or how does that look?
For us, PPP loans, I'll say we executed really, really well, round one and round two of PPP loans. And then if you look at, how sort of the first round of money went, absolutely hands down the community banks won. They took care of their clients. The big money center banks held out, you know, for whatever reasons they did. I think Wells Fargo had, you know, an asset cap looming over their head, and they were kind of holding a gun to Secretary, you know, Mnuchin's head and back and forth and said, look, we'll make PPP loans, but this asset cap, when we got in trouble a few years ago, that needs to go away. So you had some jockeying with the money center banks, which is why I don't like working for them, which is why I don't like, I think they're, you know, they are not operating, you know, altruistically when it comes to their clients. And so, you know, when PPP first rolled out, it was, you know, basically written in, you know, Sanskrit or something, or, you know, that we couldn't decode, but we knew that at the end of the day, our clients were going to get, free money, if we did it right. And so if we were operating the right way, if they made the appropriate type loan, if we did it correctly, we were going to get them free money. So they were lining up at the door. We said, first, you know, we're going to handle our clients. Now, we are in some community markets where we did establish a portal, so non-customers could go ahead and apply. And, you know, we were hoping in a lot of those cases that they do evolve into customers and that, you know, it is a chance for us to pick up some new business. But yes, round one was basically a you know, trying to take everything you can and cram it through this tiny little hole. And they were just trying to push that watermelon through. But we had, you know, our credit team, they burned the midnight oil, even just preparing the process. And so what we did here is, you know, we had instructions from SBA, gathered the applications, and then we sort of put them into our own pipeline before we electronically submitted them to SBA. So we would kind of fact check them on the front end, verify that it was, you know, acted as a backstop for our clients, and then send them on to SBA. And so, and then money ran out of the clients that contacted me that I had reached out to. We got them all funded round one. And so then, you know, the money ran out. Yeah, people were working, and it was nice that you could electronically submit. So we were able to have, you know, remote access for the credit team and the people processing that, but it was all hands on deck. I mean, we were grabbing people from like the vault clerk in your small towns to someone that used to handle like titles or mortgage. I mean, it was an all hands on deck endeavor. And then, you know, round two, everybody was just thinking, you know, well, this money's going to go even faster. And then you look up a month later and the money's still, you know, you get 150 billion that's still sitting there, 140, but you know, it wasn't all used up. And so, I don't know why that was. Maybe they allocated too much, or maybe, you know, it just, there was some level of sophistication. We did find that our highly sophisticated borrowers had all their stuff. They were able to produce the documentation, and organize it, submit it to us that, I mean, immediately we were able to get that through with just instantaneous approvals from SBA. So I don't know if maybe it had to do with the level of sophistication of borrowers that, they kind of waited, or they just saw it as a massively daunting task that they couldn't do. But no PPP, I think, in the second round, the big money center banks jumped in and you know, I think they hopefully took care of their folks, but now with the deadlines being extended and then the blend, instead of not having to be at a 75-25, labor versus, you know, other expenses, they adjusted kind of the mix, I think that's favorable. People are taking a little bit longer to spend the money. They can spend it in other areas where initially we thought, you know, they weren't going to have to, because initially it was like, look, we don't want all these people rushing to unemployment, so we're going to throw this PPP money out there, and then, you know, we're not going to have this massive flood to the unemployment line, which I think you did have a massive flood to the unemployment line, just because the PPP was kind of like shooting a BB gun at a freight train with the COVID stuff, just because retail, you know, a lot of the folks that needed it either didn't apply or they were just hit so hard that the PPP loans didn't make sense to pay people just to sit there when they were having zero revenue.
Yeah. The beginning PPP was it was like we were running a race, but we didn't know where the finish line was, and we're just sprinting everywhere, right? Like one day we're like doing the payroll, and then we can have it and the contract. And it was just like, we just got to keep sprinting, but we don't know where. So like, shout out to your team for getting 100% funded for here. I know it was hard. I know working with our team, it was like for 4 days of just like compiling. So I think by round two, people heard the horror stories from one, the amount of sophistication two, and then just kind of the question mark of like, you're getting this money, but you don't know any of the rules of the stipulation. I think it was kind of like the opportunity zone effect of like, we know this is the goal, but we don't know any of the rules, but people are kind of throwing money at it.
Yeah.
So it's just like, people are like, I want to know what I'm signing up before I go all in and head first into the pool.
So seeing a little bit behind the curtain with the government and getting to see, you know, the development side of that, I knew, and I always had, this gut feeling that, look, if this PPP program, if it just becomes such a, you know, kind of a calamity, a mass just cluster, the government is, if they try to pull one over on business owners and let's say you went and you applied for this payroll protection loan, you got it, and then they changed the rules of the game, and then it was supposed to be 100% forgivable, but then, well, hang on, we have this gotcha in here that you may not be able to get it all forgiven. That would be the last time anybody ever did an SBA loan, yep. Ever. And the SBA would just need to close its doors. So it really was incumbent upon the government to do this. And the reason they did it through the banks is because if you go, they had no way to underwrite against fraud. They would have everybody filing, you know, corporate docs and entities and producing fraudulent financials and sending them into the portal. Because I will tell you, in my experience with the payroll protection loan, whatever got sent to them got approved. And that's dangerous. And that's dangerous from a bank standpoint. And that's dangerous from giving out the amount of money they gave out, because how do you underwrite against fraud? Well, you see, I'm not going to give the money. I'm going to go to these banks that already have existing clients and they have the means to look at financials, to check, to do at least a real basic litmus check on that. So essentially pushing it through the banks was their way, means of fraud prevention for the government. And so I think that was the right thing to do. But it was, you know, like any program that was put together in, you know, a week, it was rolled out pretty poorly and tough. But at the same time, you have to look at kind of what you said, the spirit of the project was to help people. And if at the end of the day, there was some sort of gotcha, it would have been far worse than just not doing one at all. So I do believe that once this, you know, you kind of see the genesis of the program, they will be forgivable. They'll be lenient. I think, as long as you show that you use the money in good faith, I have to believe that they're not gonna gotcha to the consumer.
Yeah, and it's from a, you know, obviously I'm sure there's some complexities that made it very stressful and difficult, and there's always error in anything. But
he laughed. James is already laughing at the PTSD he got from it.
But I mean, it seems to have been, you know, decently efficient. Whereas we're not seeing major foreclosures in small businesses. I'm sure that, you know, it's still early. We'll see, you know, some blood in the water at some level, but it seems to have been, you know, the right decision in terms to provide, you know, forgivable debt to businesses and really provide liquidity to the system. I don't know if you necessarily want to touch too much on it, but would you agree for most of the sentiment that it's like, we've done a decent job so far. I mean, obviously there's some issues and nothing's going to go perfect, but it seems to have been the right amount of like support that the system needed, at least so far.
I think so. I think we played defense really, really well. And it's, you are going to see, we'll see some sensitivity in travel and hospitality and tourism related areas, because that just, I think you have a lot of people, they do want to get out and they want to go spend, but look at, you know, the airline statistics about when they were talking about, you know, 2 million travelers per day in these airports is down to, you know, in some cases 100,000, and just in airlines operating at such, you know, minimal capacities. And so those are anything that's related to the travel industry, the tourism industry. Those are where you're going to see probably, like you said, your you know, kind of that deeper cut, but yeah, it's I am pretty optimistic about just our initial assessment. You know, this is really the first time where we've been able to pick our heads up, and we had a bank-wide call the other day. And if several of our lenders, even from other markets, were saying, look, you know, I don't have anybody impacted. Our clients are doing great. These guys over here are doing this. And, you know, while they're still, I think those areas might've taken hits just to consumer confidence, but you know, it didn't resonate in poor financials or, like you said, defaults, foreclosures. And I think, again, that speaks to, I just feel like today, you know, versus 08 and even going into 05 and 06, 07, we're doing business with different types of borrowers. The credit is so much stronger from, you know, from leverage perspectives. We're looking at projects differently. We're kind of sensitizing them in different ways. And so it probably had this you know, perception out there that banks, you know, were being tighter or maybe we're being more conservative. But I think what we were trying to avoid is another downturn in which banks had to completely stop everything. And so, and that to me, I think is the win, or, you know, the, hopefully the silver lining in this is that look, banks, you know, we're not just idling, we're continuing to go and grow in certain areas, which will hopefully not just create, like you said, the domino effect in the economy.
Yeah. No, I mean, I remember even when I first started at Citibank in 2018, the CEO talking about, like, you know, we may be many years away from the recession, but we need to start preparing for it now, and would always kind of bring it up. And I even remember then being, because I was much younger, being like, we're being too over conservative. Or like,
this guy's bumming us out.
we're going to miss out on deals and things like that. And it's, you know, you see the importance of experience and understanding where you are in the market cycle, because I'm sure because of that, Citibank will be much more well-positioned in the current environment.
It's not glamorous or sexy or exciting to, you know, to work at a bank or be a part of a bank, really, unless you're, I think, in certain areas. And I get excitement from, you know, my clients. I like to live vicariously through, you know, their successes and projects and how they operate. And I enjoy spending time with them looking at deals, and, you know, we pass on some, how, you know, when some, we're moving on to phase two right now of almost a 700 lot development up in, kind of North Collin County. And that's exciting to me. And these guys are going to do so well on this thing. And I drive by there cause I can kind of go by the, you know, indirectly home that way. But it's a, you know, it's a sense of pride in that. And to me, that's, you got to get your little excitement, you know, where you can, but yeah, overall, I mean, it's how you prepare in the good times, you know, for the bad times. And really the reason too, we do that is, you know, our borrowers hate to put more money down, and they hate to, you know, sometimes they kind of, you know, feel like, you know, they're having to part with a lot, but it's ideally to engineer them to weather it just like we do, because we yep. don't want to take assets back. We don't want to see, you know, people lose stuff. The ones, you know, we want to see everybody come through stronger and then be able to be opportunistic when assets are available. And then, you know, the folks that we'd helped, you know, build good balance sheets, then, hey, look, you know, now here's an opportunity for us to maybe be opportunistic or value add, and let's, you know, see you grow that way. So,
yep. Awesome. So, running short on time here. So I wanted to dive into rates a lot more, but sure. we'll make it relatively quick. Just, can you kind of summarize essentially how a bank will quote a deal, and maybe do you know, a construction deal, and then how they'll look at a you know, a stabilized deal, and just kind of how you guys would price that out?
Sure. So you know, obviously the theme of everything is risk with a bank, and so construction is like your risk here, and then stabilized is over here. It's much lower risk. So your construction pricing is most likely going to be, and that's from the bank's perception, and from a creditor's perception. And so construction, you're probably going to have some type of variable rate pricing, a prime. Usually, it's a prime index, you know, plus something floating.
So, can you explain what prime is?
Okay. Which is a great question, because I thought about this prior to our call, and I wanted to tell you that I didn't realize there was more than one prime. until I started reading some loan documents like 15 years ago and realized that this, you know, banks are allowed to create their own prime rate. So you could have West Texas State Bank prime rate, and then you could have Wall Street Journal prime, which when everybody says prime, they're most likely meaning Wall Street Journal prime, which is set, you know, by New York, the largest, it's kind of what the largest banks agree to at.
Oh. All right, we lost James here.
Oh, sorry, there. Did I lose you guys?
Yeah.
No, there we are.
He's checking primes as we speak.
No, I was, problem with the computer and phone being connected. And so prime can be what a bank wants it to be. And so you got to be careful in knowing what that prime rate is, you know, whether it's Wall Street Journal prime, you know, which is kind of your universally accepted, or a bank specific prime rate, because those can vary greatly. But most time when we talk about prime, we're talking about Wall Street Journal prime, you know, kind of your national indices.
Okay.
But construction. So it'll have some type of floating, a variable component to it, a prime, usually a prime plus. And then as the risk diminishes, it gets into the stabilization. You know, you might go to some type of mini permanent financing. And so if you're going to give them a 5-year fixed rate, then closest thing that we can go say, well, a bank says I can go buy a 5-year bond at today it was like 0.28, or I can make a loan, a 5-year loan. And what do I have to price that at to pay for, you know, my infrastructure, and then make a spread over what, you know, banks will call their cost of funds. And so a lot of, you know, people out there looking and saying, well, rates have plummeted. How come your rates, you hit a point where I really can't go any lower, because, you know, we do have, you know, 600 employees. We do have, you know, infrastructure. We've got some fixed costs that, you know, you start to dig into, and the bank's still got to make a little bit of money. But so generally we try to do some spread off of the corresponding treasury. If it's a 3-year note, we'll do a 3-year rate. If it's a 5-year fixed, try to price it some spread off of the corresponding treasury. The ones that are now, we are seeing today, banks get more aggressive with 10 and 15 year fixed rates, 20 year fixed rates, and they're using swap and derivative products through other companies that'll basically, I'm going to go out as a bank and I'm going to buy, you know, 0.4% money, and I'm going to give it to you at 3.4% money. And so, but if I'm going to give it to you for 20 years, I am buying that money from somebody else. So I'm locking in my spread. Now, you as the end user of that money, you can't repay it for 10 years, because I may have some sort of yield maintenance or something where I can't give that money back to who I bought it from. So I think it's, but you are seeing a lot more of that today, because swaps are, you know, we're probably as low as you can get on rates. And so now's a good time to learn about swaps, because, you know, really the most basic sense of a swap is me as the bank, I'm getting money at 1%, and I'm giving it to you at 3%. So I'm making a spread. Well, if rates go up and now this person has given me money at 1%, they're going to want that money back, because now they can give it out at 4%. So they're not, my borrower is not going to have a prepayment penalty or some type of make whole penalty. But if that swap, if whoever I got the money from gave it to me at 5% and I had to loan it out at 7 or 7.5, those rates drop to 2, and, you know, they don't want that money back, because they can't loan it out at what they had it at before. So that's, and, you know, you could probably do a whole podcast on make whole provisions and yield maintenance.
There's college courses going on. Yeah. I had to do this accounting for derivatives and swaps like this. So I'm having the PTSD now. How to do the accounting for it.
we'll get off that one quick then. So most people, they do like you do though. And they start to gloss over that and like, whoa, wait a sec. And we would prefer to keep it simple. We'd prefer to do 5 and in some cases 7-year fixed rate money, where you don't have to do prepayment penalties. You don't have the yield maintenances, the make whole provisions. I will tell you that it seems like now with banks, with rates being lower, you are seeing what's called a refinance penalty, where lenders are loaning and say, okay, well, I'm going to give you guys 4.5 money for 6 years, but you can't refi my loan for 6 years or 5 years. If you sell the asset, you're not subject to any penalty. I want you to sell it and make money, and we want you to be profitable and prosperous. But if you try to refi me to another bank, then yeah, you might have a 1% refi penalty. So we are seeing banks get creative with that. We're trying to, you know, lock in some longer term, you know, call it, you know, annuitized income.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's pretty evident there that bank pricing is a little bit more complex. I mean, pricing of loans overall is a little bit more complex than it may seem. And I definitely remember asking James these questions when I started and just being like, whoa.
Well, and it changes so much by market too.
Yeah.
You know, your smaller rural markets may have different pricing than your major metropolitan areas. And so that gets back to the relationship. I mean, you want to hedge your pricing, have a bank relationship.
Yep.
That's the best way to hedge your pricing.
I was just going to say that, like just having a good local bank relationship and then a good one that you can trust that's giving you honest and fair pricing. And that way you don't have to worry about understanding the details of it, which takes time.
For sure.
Even leveraging like Will as like the broker side, he's looking at this stuff every single day versus when you're doing a deal, if you do one or two deals a year, you have no idea on the pulse of it. So just making sure you're connecting with Will and James and making sure you have a good understanding of your market, the needs and the changes, because if you don't do any deals or anything in 6 months, you're just kind of lost. Just going, what happened? Looking back, like where did I come from?
Yeah. All right. Before we go to the pro tip, let's take a moment to hear from our sponsors.
Gino, I know a lot of our listeners are wanting to take their multifamily investing business to the next level. I know that you've been hard at work helping Jake and Gino students do just that using our framework. Can you explain to the listeners how they can get our help?
Guys, we've been hard at work growing our community of like-minded investors, and the results of our members has been nothing short of incredible. We're looking to grow this amazing group. What we're looking for is those who want to follow our proprietary framework that we've created. Buy right, manage right, and finance right. Leverage our connections, education, and mentorship as ways to take your business to the next level.
So if you're interested in finding out more about how you can become a part of our amazing community, apply to work with us at jakeandgino.com/apply.
And we're back. So James, we always ask our guests to provide one investor pro tip for our listeners.
Oh, investor pro tip. I would say measure twice and cut once, because I think Will probably heard me say this ad nauseum, is that you can never recreate your buy side economics. When you've bought it, that's your price. I don't care if it's a house, if it's an apartment, if it's a hotel, you can never recreate your buy side economics. So the most important piece, measure twice, cut once, and buy it right. Because you make your money when you buy it, you don't make it when you sell it.
Yep. No, I love that. That's one of our principles here is buy right. So, well, James, we greatly appreciate you coming on and doing this. I've learned almost everything I know about loan pricing from you, I guess maybe Waylon as well a little bit. But, you've been very helpful in my career, and I am very glad that we've been able to keep in touch since I left. And I'm sure that you've provided a lot of value to the people that listen today. So thanks again for coming on.
I hope so. I appreciate you guys having me.
If anyone has any questions, what's the best way they can reach out to you?
Email or my mobile phone. You know, I try to make that as available to those if they want to. If you want me to provide the info to you, I can do that. Yeah, I'm not sure how you guys would like to share that. So,
yep.
Yeah. I would say I get excited about this. I enjoy talking banking and finance. I enjoy looking at projects and kind of spitballing ideas. And so, even if someone, has got ideas about a certain project, a location, or part of town, if you're not afraid of being told no, then.
Awesome. Well, appreciate it, James. And there you have it, everyone. Another episode of the RAN series show. If you have any questions for James, we'll have his contact in the show notes. And if you have any questions for us on what you'd like to see, reach out to us at info@rancre.com. Make sure you like, comment, share the podcast with everyone. And until next time, we'll see you next week.
Adios. We'll be right back.